Everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on John Swinton. Right after this message. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, the former editor of the New York Tribune, when he said to the New York Press Association on February the 26th, 1936, he said, quote, "There's no such thing as a free and independent press in America unless it's in some country town. And there's not one of you who dares to express an honest opinion because you know beforehand it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid $150 a week for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid for doing similar things. Now, if I should permit my honest opinions to be printed in one issue of my paper like Othello before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone." Our business, he said, is to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his race and his country for his daily bread. We are the tools of rich men behind the scenes. We are intellectual prostitutes. Unquote. Well, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order. Men and families like the Windsors, the Rockefellers, Bushes, Bundys, Carnegies, the Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all of these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy and this New World Order, why don't you call and order my 4-hour compact disc package? It's educational, it's entertaining, informative, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org, click on the email, and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Now, that quotation from John Swinton is quite a statement. I've used it over the years, probably the last 15 or 20 years. I can't remember where the statement came from. But I got an email the other day from a listener, and the fellow's name is Todd, the listener, and he said, listen to this. He said, "I was listening to your show this morning, and I heard one of your advertisements, the one in which you quote John Swinton. And I was curious about the quote, having heard it so many times and finding it so poignant. So I decided to look it up and find the quote for myself. Well, apparently, there's a little bit of confusion as to the date in which he said this. According to the information that I found, Mr. Swinton died in 1901, calling into question the speech in the 1930s. However, what's more interesting is that this speech may have been given much earlier, perhaps as early as 1853. Check out the links that I've added and see if you don't find them compelling. Signed, Todd. Well, when I got this, Todd, I looked at it and said, my God, this is the second time this month. Remember, I made a mistake on the 12 days of Christmas, and I had to eat crow on that one. And I thought, gosh, am I going to have to eat crow on this John Swinton quotation that I've been using in my school and in my advertising here for, well, many, many years. I can't tell you if it's 10, 15, 20 years, maybe longer. So first of all, when I take one of these quotations, it's pretty obvious that I'm not smart enough to come up with a statement like that. That's my conclusion, so I have to get that from someplace, but I don't always remember where I get my quotation. Sometimes I'll take something out of a newspaper or a Time magazine or U.S. News and World Report. I may get it from a book. Sometimes I read a Jerry Spence book one time, and I took a quotation out of the Spence book over a Professor Nielsen, who had a citation that he made. I can go back to the Spence book, but I couldn't remember where I got the Swinton quotation. And I got to thinking and thinking about it, and I said, well, now, you know, it must have come from someplace. So we looked up the sources, and sure enough, John Swinton, a real live fella who lived and died, actually made that quotation, or something pretty close to it. But the truth of the matter is, a quotation needs to be cited word for word. Otherwise, it's not a quotation, it's a paraphrase of what somebody said. And remember, I've said that this is a citation or a quotation, and so I think maybe some research is in order. So I put a research man on the job, and I said, well, Dirk, go look this up. See if you can find John Swinton in 1853, and when was he born, when did he die, how important was he? Keeping in mind, of course, that not every quotation that's made by everyone, you know, I've made a lot of famous quotations in my lifetime. I'm not sure that anybody ever wrote them down and that they're going to cite them after I'm dead, but I'm the one that came up with this famous quote Bill Clinton acts like a hillbilly in a whorehouse with a credit card. Now, you've probably heard that a time or two, and I would like someday for somebody to put that citation into some book somewhere and say, George Gordon said that. Now, the truth of the matter is, I didn't think that up either. I got it from my wife, and she probably got that from somebody who got that from somebody who got that from somebody else. And, you know, the truth of the matter is every citation or every neat statement that somebody makes written down somewhere. Well, in the case of John Swinton, the answer is yes. He must have been important enough to write it down because variations, and this is John Swinton on the independence of the press, variations on the quote below have been misattributed as a response to a toast by John Swinton as the former chief of staff of the New York Times before the New York Press Club in 1953. However, research reveals that Swinton, who was born in 1829 and died in 1901, after moving to New York, wrote an occasional article for the New York Times, and he was hired on a regular basis in 1860 as head of the editorial staff. Afterward, holding his position throughout the Civil War, he left the New York Times in 1870 and became active in the labor struggles of the day. He later served 8 years in the same position on the New York Sun, and then later published a weekly labor sheet, John Swinton's paper. The remarks were apparently made by Swinton, then the preeminent New York journalist, probably one night in 1880. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft. Someone who knew neither the press nor Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Well, John Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying, quote, "There's no such thing at this date of the world's history in America as an independent press. You know it and I know it. There's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. If I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours my occupation would be gone. The business of journalists is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it, and I know it, and what folly is this toasting an independent press? We are the tools of vassals of rich men behind the scenes," he said. "We're the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents are possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes," unquote. Now, the source of that quotation is Labor's Untold Story by Richard O. Boyer and Herbert M. Moraes, published by United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America in New York in 1955 and 1979. Now, despite the misattribution, the quote raises the issue of whether there is not continuing truth in Swinton's remarks and whether some candid journalist might not be able to fairly say similar things today. Anyone who has associated closely with journalists can hardly avoid finding a ring of truth in such words, and the best evidence lies in the actual product of journalists and how well or how poorly that it both agrees with and covers what actually happens, especially involving such things as corruption and abuse of power. So for more on the misattribution, see John Swinton. Yes, he said it, but. Well, there, Todd, is one part of the story. John Swinton actually did make the statement that I've been quoting for many years. I'm going to change. I'll send that upstairs, and we'll have Swinton's actual statement that he made in 1880, not 1936. But it struck a chord with me. I said, well, how in the world did I get a direct quotation? Now, here it is on my page. And it was actually dated the New York Press Association, February 26, 1936. Well, where did the date February 26, 1936 come from? Because it's obvious that the book wasn't written until 1955. So that quotation appeared in a book published in 1955. And yet, here it is in my page, and it says February 26, 1936. What's worse, this guy John Swinton, who actually did make this quotation or something very close to it, died in 1901. Pretty obvious that he didn't address the New York Press Association February the 26th, 1936. So the nearest that I could figure the answer to that riddle would be something like this. I picked up the quotation, which was quoted from some source. It may have been quoted in Reader's Digest or the USA Today, some newspaper, some periodical. It may have been in some book. I don't know. But it probably was a paraphrase. Somebody must have addressed the New York Press Association on February the 26th, 1936, and then used the John Swinton citation so that Swinton's citation was actually cited on February the 26th, 1936, and where it should have been Swinton's statement, it was actually recorded as Swinton's actual comments and that he delivered it. but then the actual citation is not quoted verbatim from what is cited in the book printed in 1955. So, my guess is that I picked it up as a direct citation, and I believe that it was true, accurate, and correct, when in fact it was not. Now, Rents.com has a story on the Swinton saga. Now, the reason that I like the Swinton story, because if it's true, and if John Swinton actually said this, which he evidently did, because we have more than one source that we can go to, and remember, God tells us that the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall the matter be established. We actually have a second source over here, Rents, to go along with this first source over here, the Constitution.org publishing Swinton, and it's from Home Public Education, and there's two or three websites here. So my citation is on point. The details of it are the dates are incorrect. That's the substance of it. But actually, the citation, if it was made in 1880 rather than 1936, is even more telling. Because one of the protocols, these are the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, which was written about 1884, made this observation. And they said, "We shall saddle the press and hold a tight rein upon it." You've probably heard me make that quotation more than once. And they said, "And at this time, all of the news from around the world comes to us in centralized form," which is about true. The AP, the UPI, Reuters, and etc. All of the news from around the world, whether it's from Iraq or from Washington, D.C. or Sacramento, California, when we get it in our newspapers or we hear it on the 6 o'clock news, it's always the same story. Once in a while, they screw up, and they tell too much of the story too soon, and it gets reported on CNN immediately as the story is breaking, like the Oklahoma City bombing, and then they have to cover that up. And they do that. And then from then on, you say, "What happened to that first story?" Well, it was incorrect, and so we pulled it. When in reality, the first thing that came out of there was probably correct, and we weren't supposed to know that, and so they covered it up. And that's the story that Swinton was making. That news is made not because they want to inform us, but because they want to indoctrinate us. There's a big difference between information and indoctrination. Well, here's what Rents has to say about it. John Swinton, yes, he said it, but I got an email from Jay Salter, one of my readers, who had come across the Snowcrest.net voices on John Swinton. One journalist there, a fellow by the name of Jeff McMahon, made this response to Jay. He said, "Yeah, I'll take the bait." And McMahon goes on to say, "The last time I saw that phony quote, Swinton was identified as the chief of staff of the New York Sun. The date was 1853, and where it now says I am paid weekly, it then said I'm paid $150 a week, which is actually about how much I made in journalism. Then some liar realized that newspapers don't have chiefs of staff, at least the editorial departments don't. And if you're going to lie, you might as well do it big. So they made him the editor-in-chief of the New York Times in 1953. Unfortunately, the editor of the New York Times in 1953 was Turner Catledge. Now, looking at my quotation, I'm going to interrupt here. Looking at my quotation, it says that he was making this statement to the New York Press Association. And there's no such thing as a free and independent press in America unless it's in some country town. And there's not one of you who dares to express an honest opinion because you know beforehand it would never appear in print. Now, it says here that he was the former editor of the New York Tribune, not the New York Times. And it says in my sheet that it has him being paid $150 a week, which would have been a pretty good salary for a person living in the 1930s. And $150 a week is probably about what people were being paid in editorial rooms in the 1930s. But the real John Swinton back in 1880 did not make reference to the Tribune. In fact, he never worked for the Tribune, according to the biography of Swinton. So my paper is wrong on that point. $150 a week, that's not correct. Swinton didn't say he made $150 a week. He didn't say how much he made. And that's why McMahon here, in analyzing this, calls this a lie. And it's a lie because they're claiming that it is a quotation from Swinton, when in reality it's not a direct quotation, but rather a paraphrase of what he said. Paraphrased, that is, let me take a little editor's license, and I'll tell you what he said. Here's what Swinton said, and then I would tell you in my own words what Swinton said, as opposed to a quotation which is Swinton's actual words. So, George Gordon has been remiss these 20 years in citing John Swinton, the lying version. But McMahon now goes behind the scenes to find where did this lying version come from. So the quote itself betrays a need for journalists, because otherwise people who spread such propaganda might go unchecked. And I agree with McMahon that that propaganda should not go unchecked. We should check it out. Now, that having been said, I will acknowledge that this cheap lie, like most cheap lies, has some truth to it. I think it is expressed rather bitterly, personally, but I'm sure every journalist with any history in the biz has had at least one day when they felt the same way. It's the very reason that I gladly applied the word former to the word journalist when it is attached to my name. Indeed, New York Times executive editor Max Frankel said something very similar about the impact of profiteering on journalism after he retired in 1994. Frankel probably isn't quoted quite so widely because Frankel doesn't use 21st century, neo, Old Testament, Naderite phraseology like fawn at the feet of mammon. What John Swinton describes is not so easily described, or it would have been dealt with. It's more like a constant. It's more of a subtle pressure to bend to power, a pressure that can be defied, and maybe even often, but that does not seem to ever go away. The strong spend a career tilting against it. The weak let it direct them, and as you can see every day in this country's media. It certainly is not true that you can never write your true opinion in the American press. McMahon goes on to say, I wrote my true opinion plenty of times, most recently when I wrote that commentary about the Hearst Ranch. It managed to pass through two editors and a publisher without one word being changed. However, no anti-Hearst commentary can run in this country without a Steve Hearst commentary on the very same page. And who is responsible for that? Is it the fault of the journalists? No. For that subversion of truth, the integrity that we can thank our country's professional greenwashers for. Anyway, before posting such, we should consider how our brothers and sisters in the Newspaper Guild might feel about such a broad brush defilement of a very diverse group of largely hardworking and unanimously agreed underpaid men and women who work in journalism, particularly the printed press. Now, I suppose the following bumper sticker, support your local fact checker. In cheerful solidarity, Jeff McMahon. Well, okay, Jay forwarded McMahon's response back to me, and since I would like to keep things reasonably accurate on my webpage, I went looking to see if I could verify or dispute the Swinton vignette. And it turned out, surprise of surprises, that like most really good stories, it contained a little bit of truth and a little bit of fiction, and unlike most really good stories, the reality behind the story is even more interesting. And here's that story. Yes, Virginia, there was a real John Swinton, and yes, he was an editor of the New York Times, and yes, he did say the remarks that were attributed to him. However, he did not say it at a retirement party, and he did not make these statements as an editor of the Times, and he certainly did not say it in 1953 for the simple reason that he died in 1901. Now, a web search turned up the same vignette word for word as I had it in hundreds of locations. However, as McMahon notes, there are several variations on the theme, including one which had him born in 1829 and giving the remarks at a retirement party in 1918. He would have been at least 88 years old, a feisty old bastard at that, what with being dead 17 years and all. But it did hit pay dirt in some old areas. John Swinton was in fact born in 1829. He did in fact die in 1901. The managing editor of the New York Times during the Civil War was John Swinton, who later became a crusading journalist in the movement for social and labor reform. Scottish born, Swinton learned typesetting in Canada before moving to the United States. During the trouble in Kansas, he was active in the Free Soil movement and headed the Lawrence Republican. Moving back to New York, he wrote an occasional article for the New York Times, and he was hired on a regular basis in 1860. He was the head of the editorial staff of the New York Times. After holding this position throughout the Civil War, he left the paper in 1870, and he became active in the labor struggles of his day. He later served 8 years in the same position on the New York Sun and published a weekly labor sheet called John Swinton's Paper. At another location, Ayer Company Publishers, I came across this information. John Swinton. A momentous question. A respective attitudes of labor, or the respective attitudes of labor, and capital introduction by Leon Stein and Philip Taft. In 1883, John Swinton founded a four-page independent labor paper known simply as John Swinton's Paper. And for the next 4 years, until he could no longer sustain it, he made it the voice of the workers. His book reflects his continuing concern for the interrelationship between the workers and political and economic events. In particular, it provides a close-up view of the dramatic sympathy strike of the railroad workers who made the cause of the Pullman strike their own. It is fully documented with statements by the chief participants, including Debs, Gompers, John W. Hayes, treasurer of the Knights of Labor, and Governor Altgeld and President Grover Cleveland. It was published in Philadelphia and Chicago in 1895 for $28.95, which, just to put my 2 cents worth in, $28.95 in 1895 was a god-awful chunk of money. Well, from this we can surmise that he was disaffected with capitalism and the American media, making the remarks attributed to him much more credible. And it turns out that he has peripheral involvement in a trial in 1885 in Illinois. This is Illinois versus August Spies et al. And he is regarded by the defendants, hardcore Marxists, as being ironically too fond of and trusting in the media and democracy. Here's the People's Exhibit number 38, the alarm February 21st, 1885, the Dynamite Terror. It says, as for the American people, the thing to bear in mind is that here the ballot can be wielded that there shall be no need of resorting to force for the cure of any public evil, however deep-rooted or malignant. That was John Swinton citing that in John Swinton's paper. Now, the above is the concluding paragraph of a lengthy article of John Swinton's paper last week, and we're surprised to see our old friend bow at the shrine of that capitalistic humbug called the ballot. America is not a free country. The economic condition of the workers here are precisely the same as they are in Europe. A wage slave is a slave everywhere, without any regard to the country he may happen to have been born in or made the living in. Friend Swinton, how can the industrially enslaved be politically free? How can a man without the right to live possess the right to vote? And you gave the facts and illustrations in your own columns, which proves that the hand which holds the bread can alone wield the ballot. And what do you mean by public evils? Do you mean the political offices with its bribery and corruption? And that image, People's Exhibit 38, page 2, all the workers have to do in order to be saved is to turn the rascals out? Well, from a Democratic point of view, President Cleveland will. And he'll do that after the 4th of March next. The outs will go in and the ins will go out. But surely you cannot mean that the wage slave will no longer be a slave. Here in America, the worker is deprived of life, liberty, and happiness, the Declaration of Independence to the contrary notwithstanding, in spite of, yes, mainly by means of the ballot. With a copy of the Declaration of Independence in one hand and the ballot in the other, the wage worker is deluded into the belief that he is free, a free man, and a sovereign. Swinton made another statement. He said, the poor have no votes. Poverty can't vote. For itself, wealth alone can vote. The workers vote wrong because they're poor, and the poor because they're robbed of their inheritance, the land, robbed of their right to the free use of all of the resources of life, the means of existence. The workers are deprived of all opportunity to acquire and to apply knowledge. They're deprived of all access to culture and refinement. For the perpetuation of these evils, they have to thank government, the state, and the ballot box, and the politicians. Politicians and the state are the legitimate, inevitable outgrowth of the profit-mongering system of wage slavery based upon competition and wages. We cannot get rid of the former until we remove the latter. Swinton went on to say, the deep-rooted malignant evil which compels the image, People's Exhibit 38, page 3, that compels the wealth producers to become the dependent hirelings of a few capitalistic czars cannot be reached by means of the ballot. And the ballot can be wielded by freemen alone, but slaves can only revolt and rise in insurrection against their despoilers. And Swinton went on, he said, let us bear in mind the fact that here in America, as elsewhere, the worker is held in economic bondage by the use of force, and the employment of force, therefore, becomes a necessity to his economic emancipation. Poverty can't vote. Well, at www.trunkerton.fsnet.co, journalism, I found that what I believe may be a more accurate rendition of the story, given what I learned of the manus far-left politics, a voice nearly dead in our comfortable corporate existence today. I find it easy to believe that he did say that which was attributed to him. However, the claim that he so said as managing editor of the New York Times, and that he made the statement in 1953, appeared to be nothing more than misguided efforts to give the story catchit and topicality. As for Mr. McMahon's response, I would say that he is entirely correct in saying that the story creates an unfair image of the media. However, with the possible exception of Hunter S. Thompson, there are no Swintons in the American media these days, and I would ask Mr. McMahon why he thinks that is so. A media that presents only half the range of opinion is presenting no information at all. Now, one night, probably in 1880, John Swinton, then the preeminent New York journalist, was the guest of honor at a banquet given him by the leaders of his craft. Someone who knew neither the press nor Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying. And in his reply, here's what he said, quote, there is no such thing at this date of the world's history in America as an independent press. You know it and I know it. There is not one of you who dares to write your honest opinion, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. I am paid weekly for keeping my honest opinion out of the paper that I am connected with. Others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. If I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalists is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it and I know it. And what folly is this toasting an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents are possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Unquote. Well, Todd, in the future, I'm going to take that direct quote right out of his statement made in 1880. So we now know that John Swinton was a real-life guy, made the statement, wasn't quite correct, and it wasn't made at the time that I alleged that it had been made. All right. Thank you very much for your letter. And now that I've been set straight and everybody else is set straight on the Swinton story, we will then go on to the next story for the day. But before we get into the secret list of ID theft victims, let me give you a caveat here and tell you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law School. The Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. The secret list of ID theft victims. Consumers could be warned, but the U.S. government isn't talking. Linda Trevino, who lives in a Chicago suburb, applied for a job last year at the local Target department store, and she was denied. The reason? Well, she already worked there. Well, at least her Social Security number already worked there. Follow-up investigation revealed the same Social Security number had been used to obtain work at 37 other employers, mostly by illegal immigrants trying to satisfy government requirements to get a job. Trevino is hardly alone. MSNBC.com research and government reports suggest hundreds of thousands of American citizens are in the same spot, unknowingly lending their identity to illegal immigrants so that they can work. And while several government agencies and private corporations sometimes know whose Social Security numbers are being ripped off, they will not notify the victims, that is, until they come after the victims for back taxes or unpaid loans owed by the imposter. Did you hear that? Now let's back up for a minute and think about this. If your Social Security number is being used by 37 other people, that means that Social Security deductions are being made by 37 employers from 37 different locations. Now it's pretty obvious that you don't have 37 jobs paying into that one account. Now Social Security knows that there's something wrong there, but they don't tell you. Now how do you like them apples? Now the question arises, well, if the government knows this, why don't they call you on the phone and say, are you really working at 37 different jobs, and do you really have 37 different employers, and is this number being used in 37 different locations with your knowledge and consent? You know, it's a thorny problem that cuts to the heart of America's undocumented worker issue. Immigration opponents say that it's just another reason to shut the borders tight. Immigrant rights groups point out that identity theft is an inevitable outcome of unfair labor laws that push foreign visitors deeper into the shadows. Either way, immigrant imposters with the least nefarious of intentions, simply a desire to work, often unknowingly victimize the rightful Social Security number holders. The problem is compounded by how often ripped-off numbers are being used. James Lee, the chief marketing officer for private data collection firm Choice Point, said the average victim of immigrant-based identity theft sees their Social Security number shared about 30 times. 30 times. The numbers get passed around a family and around whole neighborhoods, he said. People need to wake up to this problem, said Richard Hamp. He's an assistant attorney general for the state of Utah who has prosecuted several cases involving stolen IDs and illegal immigrants. They're destroying people's credit, Social Security benefits, and everything else. The problem has been ignored by the federal government, and it is enormous. But could Trevino and all the other victims be warned by the government? After all, several agencies and corporations found her when they wanted her money. Until then, not a single one of these government agencies or employers had bothered to even call her and warn her that someone else was using her Social Security number. Melody Millett's husband, Steve, was the victim of immigrant identity theft. None of the agencies involved are trying to tackle the problem because they all benefit from it, as does corporate America, she said. The IRS and Social Security collect extra taxes. Lenders sell more loans, and employers get inexpensive workers. Fixing the problem and telling all the victimized consumers would upset the delicate apple cart that is America's immigration policy, she said. The government is forcing people to share identities because they want to provide cheap labor to corporate America, so said Melody Millett. And an undocumented immigrant worker managed to use Steve Millett's social security number for more than 10 years before the incident was discovered. Millett said the imposter managed to obtain a dozen credit cards, buy a car, and even a house using the stolen number in his own name. All the while, that imposter paid taxes, paid into Social Security, he took out loans using the stolen Social Security number. All of those agencies had a record of the abused Social Security number, and not a one of them bothered to tell Steve Millett. Not one, over a period of 10 years. You can't find out except by accident, Melody Millett said. They're not required to notify us. No one is required to notify you. The way it sits now, our lives are ruined. We'll never have again a normal financial life. $420 billion in accounting limbo. Well, quantifying the problem of immigrant imposters is a challenge. Neither the IRS nor the Social Security Administration has even bothered trying. But there are some solid hints suggesting hundreds of thousands of people are currently at risk. And right now, lending their identity to an undocumented worker, and they don't even know it. With every paycheck, U.S. workers pay FICA taxes. Those taxes are destined for Social Security funds and for the Social Security Administration. But each year, millions of payments are made to the agency with mismatched names and numbers. The Social Security Administration has no idea who deserves credit for the taxes paid by those wage earnings. So no one gets it. The amount of uncredited Social Security wages is now an enormous $420 billion, an amount that sits in what's called the earnings suspense file. It's an accounting limbo called the suspense file. During 2002, the year with the most recent figures available, 9 million people paid taxes with mismatched names and mismatched Social Security numbers. Some were women who had failed to notify the agency that their name changed after marriage. Some were the result of typographical errors. But most, between 50 and 80%, depending on whom you talk to, represent illegal immigrants using a stolen or manufactured Social Security number at the workplace. The amount of money headed for the earnings suspense file began to skyrocket after 1986, when a new federal law required workers to produce Social Security cards to get employment. In 2001, Social Security reports indicated 35% of the wages in the fund were earned by workers in California. In 2002, 46% of the wages that ended up in the suspense fund came from immigrant-heavy industries like agriculture. Restaurants and other services, according to Social Security Office of the Inspector General, made up the balance. Both facts suggest to analysts that much of the fund is the result of payments made by undocumented immigrant workers. It's unclear now as to how many of those millions of payments made by undocumented workers are made using someone else's Social Security numbers. Audits show that many are made with manufactured numbers such as 000000000, but people familiar with the data say the list would point to hundreds of thousands of identity theft victims. Still, James Hughes Jr., former Inspector General of the Social Security Administration, said it is unlikely that the agency will ever inform potential victims. The list would be a terrific source of leads for the identity remediation effort, but there are so many other compelling workloads in front of SSA, I don't know what can they do with that today, he said. Also, the politics of immigration get involved in this. A spokesman for the Social Security Administration said the agency simply could not disclose the information to consumers because doing so would run afoul of federal law. That information is considered to be tax return information. It's governed under the Internal Revenue Code, or so said Social Security's Mark Lesseter. There are strict limitations on disclosure. Can someone see if anyone else has reported earnings under their Social Security number? And the answer under the current law would be no. The IRS also receives payments from mismatched names and numbers and has access to the same no-match list created by Social Security. But according to the IRS spokesman, Anthony Burke, the agency doesn't check for number name mismatches until it processes tax returns, and it does not have a mechanism for informing the rightful Social Security number holder that someone else has filed a tax return using that number. When tax returns are filed with wrong Social Security numbers, some 500,000 were filed last year, the agency simply notifies the filer in writing. The rightful number holder isn't told, because there's no way to know why the wrong number was used, Burke said. And credit reports don't help either. How can a consumer unravel the secret life of their Social Security number? In fact, since neither the government nor private industry is speaking out, there's no way. And asking the Social Security Administration or IRS will not help you either. Most consumers only discover the situation when their imposters take the next step up the economic ladder, securing credit using the stolen number. And even then, the victims may not be told unless the imposter misses a loan payment or otherwise sends creditors hunting for their money. That's because, thanks to a quirk in the credit system, credit obtained by imposters using their real name, but a stolen Social Security number, doesn't appear on the victim's credit report. Now, this so-called SSN-only identity theft poses a unique set of problems for consumers and the nation's credit bureaus. If credit is granted by a lender, an entry is made in credit bureau files, but not disclosed to the consumer who properly owns that number. Even when a consumer gets a copy of a credit report, such fraudulent accounts don't appear on the report. Instead, the bureaus create what are sometimes called subfiles. Those subfiles act like separate identities in their databases. In fact, consumer credit reports obtained from the credit bureaus expressly leave off this kind of fraud. And if an imposter is using a consumer's social security number but his own name and address to open up fraudulent accounts, a consumer disclosed credit report will not include that information. The rightful number holder will never know about it. A lender, however, might find out. Even see all of the accounts that an imposter has opened using a victim's social security number. Millet, who has sued the credit bureaus, said her husband was denied a credit card even though his credit report was spotless and he had a superb credit score of 700. Businesses interested in giving credit to a consumer can pay to see any activity connected to a particular social security number. Consumers cannot. All three credit bureaus sell specialized services with names like Social Search that track the entire history of a social security number. The services are not available to consumers. Privacy concerns prevent consumers from seeing a social security number only report, said Equifax's David Rubinger. Companies that have signed agreements with us can access data like that, but we can't let every consumer see it, he said. It would be difficult for the firm to establish definitively who the rightful social security number holder is, and there would still be potentially sticky privacy issues related to revealing the imposter's information. Don Gerrand, a spokesman for Experian, acknowledged his firm had seen the problem, but said that it was extremely rare. I can tell you that we have quite a few people looking into this, he said. TransUnion did not respond to requests for interviews for this report. Total purgatory for taxpayers is the net result of this practice. Frustration can mount for victims of this kind of fraud. Eventually, the government agencies involved do catch up with the legitimate consumer. But often not until they're looking for money. Victims can have trouble getting disability or unemployment benefits. Others find the Internal Revenue Service on their backs looking for payment of back taxes for wages earned by their imposters. Some see refunds held up by the confusion. Others see their wages garnished. Trevina found herself in a financial nightmare. All those imitators made a mess out of her work history, her Social Security benefits record, and her credit report. She was haunted by bills and creditors. She received threatening letters from the IRS telling her to pay taxes on money earned by her imposters. She was told to repay unemployment benefits that she had received after the government discovered that she was working while drawing benefits. At the time, she said, I'm thinking, I'm unemployed. I wish I could have at least one job, let alone all these different jobs, she said. This is total purgatory that this puts U.S. citizen taxpayers into, said Marty Dinnerstein. He's the president of Immigration Matters, a public policy analysis firm. It's a nightmare to get it stopped, and when they do get it stopped, it's only for that particular year. The whole mess could begin again anew in the next tax year. But neither Social Security nor the IRS will tell consumers that something unusual is happening with their Social Security numbers, and it seems that consumers are the last ones that get in on the joke. This is the schizophrenia of the federal government. Hughes, the former Social Security Inspector General, said, the Homeland Security people are screaming about the accuracy of records, and you have the IRS taking money from wherever it comes. Mismatches go totally unchecked, and since the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, workers must produce a Social Security card or similar identity verification when obtaining employment. Employers are supposed to verify that the card is legitimate, but many don't. By creating a black market for counterfeit Social Security cards, the law that they have inadvertently kicked off the identity theft crisis. Experts say the identity theft crisis begins with the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. It is 100% government-sponsored. It's truly an unintended consequence of the 1986 immigration law, said Marilyn Hincapie of the National Immigration Law Center. That's why there is this need for comprehensive immigration reform. For now, with the tacit approval from all involved, undocumented workers buy counterfeit cards from suppliers who steal or simply manufacture Social Security numbers. One of these manufactured numbers just may coincide with your number. About 90% of the time in cases that he's investigated, Utah's Hamp said that the numbers used belong to a real person. But even in the other cases, there's still harm done. The number may be issued in the future, meaning that a baby may be born with a surprising financial past. You could end up at birth with a bad credit history and a bad work record, Hamp said. The Social Security Administration has made some efforts to straighten out its records, sending letters to hundreds of thousands of businesses asking that they follow up on name number mismatches. In 2002, the agency sent 900,000 letters to companies that had workers using erroneous names or numbers. The letters confused employers and employees alike. Some workers fled immediately. Other employers fired workers on the spot. Immigration rights groups objected, pointing out that inclusion in a no-match list was not an automatic indicator of illegal status. The effort did little to reduce the earnings suspense file or fix Social Security accounting, so the agency backed off, and they don't do this any longer. Meanwhile, the IRS, which is charged with enforcing the requirement that employers collect accurate Social Security number data, has never once levied a fine against a corporation or an employer for failing to do so. So the change, then, is tied up with the key policy shifts. The issue of Social Security number abuse is getting some attention as the Bush administration presses ahead on two related issues, that is Social Security reform and undocumented worker legalization. The single best way to reduce the amount of entries into the earnings suspense file and remove the need for immigrant identity theft would be to provide a path to legal status for the undocumented workers. Well, anyway, that's what some of these government agents believe. You know, if you didn't have a Social Security number or you resigned it and didn't participate in the government welfare program, it wouldn't be a problem, would it? Identity theft isn't possible. Isn't possible for those of us that practice the Mosaic law. That's right. See, we don't have any contracts with the government. Those of us that practice the law of Moses don't have birth certificates, marriage licenses, Social Security numbers, driver's licenses, business licenses. We don't do business with the government, and we don't have any problems that are derived from these kinds of government-created nightmares. In this case, this is government created. That doesn't mean that you ought to change overnight. I'm not here as a crusader trying to get you to give up your Social Security number. I'm just pointing out that there's a problem out there, and it's not a problem to those of us that don't participate in the free lunch. All right, I'm about out of time. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal. It says time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.